I'm Adam Coleman. Welcome to The Cosmic Library, the show about infinite digressions and tangents. And this season, called Mosaic Mosaic, we're following our tangents through and beyond the Hebrew Bible, a sacred text in multiple religions, the central one in Judaism. Its Hebrew name is Tanakh, after its three sections, Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, T-N-K, Tanakh. Torah comprises the five books of Moses, starting with Genesis, that book of Adam, Eve, Cain, and Abel, running through the story of Noah and the flood, on through the patriarchal line devoted to God, the patriarchal line of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, whose name becomes Israel and whose descendants are thus called the Israelites. The Torah follows the history of the Israelites into Egypt and out. After Torah, there's Nevi'im, the prophets, which includes chronicles of kings like King David, King Solomon. Then there's the third part, Ketuvim, or writings, where you'll find Psalms, Proverbs, the book of Job, Ecclesiastes. So it's a wide-ranging book that asks for wide-ranging attention, meaning too that it's a book open to so much possibility. Thus, it's sacred in multiple traditions. But it's also just everywhere. A version of the Hebrew Bible is in just about every hotel room in America, as the Old Testament in the Christian Bible. There's something else that makes this an almost omnipresent, multifaceted book. And that's this. The Hebrew Bible is particularly interested in the mysteries of language. Here's the novelist Joshua Cohen.
Why are there words? Why are there words? Why do these words, why are there letters, actually? Why do the letters form words? This is the most basic question of the Bible. You have Bereshit, right? In the beginning, Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim ve'et ha-aretz, right? Ve'aretz is etahu v'vohu, right? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth was without form and void, right? So Bereshit, you know, it's the first letter of the Torah is the second letter of the alphabet. It's bet. In other words, the first letter, Aleph, the silent letter, is not given. Why does the Torah begin with the second letter of the alphabet? What does that mean about the Aleph? What does it mean about the powers and properties of these living letters that can be combined to give life? So what does God say the first time God speaks? He says, Vayehi Or, like, you know, let there be light. And there was. So the idea that language has a creationary power, the idea that, you know, if spoken by God, and then later the Kabbalists would argue, you know, by a mystic, one could create life through the combination of letters.
When the first person, Adam, is created, his first impulse is linguistic. Here's Robert Alter's translation from the second chapter of Genesis. And the Lord God fashioned from the soil each beast of the field and each fowl of the heavens and brought each to the human to see what he would call it. And whatever the human called a living creature, that was its name. And the human called names to all the cattle and to the fowl of the heavens and to all the beasts of the field. This is language about what language can do. Language, it turns out, is a means of exploration. It's how you get to know a place. At least, it's how Adam does. And that mental adventure through language will be the focus of this season. But to start this all off, just think about the music of the text itself. The poet and translator of Hebrew poetry, Peter Cole, described to me language in the book of Exodus of the Torah.
One of the passages that comes to mind is where Moses is describing the sanctuary or Mishkan that Bezalel, whose name means in the shadow of God, will build. And what really drew me in here was the rhythm and recollection of technical matters, of technique, not some grand narrative or vision from without, but it just the rhythm and the patterns of the description and, as I say, of the recollection that spoke to me and still speaks to me in some ways deeper than the grand stuff. And Moses said unto the children of Israel, see, the Lord hath called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And he hath filled him with the Spirit of God in wisdom, in understanding, and in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, and to devise skillful works to work in gold, and in silver, and in brass, and in cutting of stones for setting, and in carving of wood to work in all manner of skillful workmanship. And he hath put in his heart that he may teach both he and Aholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan. Them hath he filled with wisdom of heart to work all manner of workmanship of the craftsmen and of the skillful workmen and of the weaver in colors in blue and in purple and scarlet and in fine linen and of the weaver, even of them that do any workmanship and of those that devise skillful works.
There's a felt dimension of these literary rhythms, connecting text with readers centuries apart. The poet and critic Elisa Gabbert, who you'll hear more from in episodes to come, mentioned to me how poetry in general, beyond just the Bible, emanates across time.
There's something so powerful about, I mean, when you read an old poem, a poem by somebody who's dead, sometimes long dead, and it feels like just like how you're feeling, that's so amazing. And it makes you feel less lonely in such a strange, specific way, because you're connecting to somebody that, you know, you could never possibly cross paths with.
A note on the time period you're spanning when it comes to this subject. The events of the Hebrew Bible run from the start of everything to a period of recognizable historical figures, to events like the reign of Nebuchadnezzar II, the Babylonian king who besieged Jerusalem in the 6th century before the Common Era. Robert Alter, in the introduction to his translation of the Torah, writes, "Sundry literary sources were probably edited and fashioned into a single book, the first properly canonical book with binding authority on the national community, sometime in the 6th century BCE. So we're talking about something ancient. Joshua Cohen described to me the book's foundational status in his own Jewish education.
I heard people talk about the Bible. I don't know that I associated the Bible with Torah. I think I was introduced to it at such a young age, I didn't have even an idea that this was at least part of it was a mutual document of a number of different cultures.
When you're reading the Bible as an adult, is there just this uncanny sense of sort of this childhood experience clashing with the adult reader? Or like, how do those two coexist? You're reading of it now or reading of it as an adult with the way that you received it as a child?
You know, I don't sit at home and read the Bible. You know, I was never, to be very honest with you, taken by the Bible. I mean, by Bible in this sense, I want to say that I'm speaking about Torah. I'm speaking about what people call the Old Testament, the five books of Moses. I was never much taken by it because it was always something that was presented to me as very holy. We read it in a scroll, but then, when we had prayers in the morning, but when we studied it in class, we had it in, bound books and books. If you dropped the book, you had to pick it up and kiss it. There was a hierarchy to how you would stack the books in terms of holiness, so as not to kind of bury the Torah under books of lesser holiness, and pretty much every book is a book of lesser holiness. And also, it seemed enormously basic in the tradition. I mean, it's basal in the tradition in the sense of the rest of the tradition is based on it. But it seemed basic and simple, and as a child, as a young student, I wanted to progress as quickly as possible to what seemed to me the more interesting stuff, which was Talmud, which was, Gemara, Mishnah, and, as reflected on the page of a Talmud, which is the commentary on, Mishnah is the oral law, and then the commentary on the oral law, which all referred back to the written law, which is the Torah, which is the Bible. And I think my earliest attraction to that was just, frankly, being a kid and seeing that the Torah page that I'm looking at is a very basic page. It looks like an English language page, except the writing goes in the other direction. But it's, lines, 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 lines. And a Talmud page to a kid just looked so much more complicated, so much more complex with these different fonts, these different alphabets, these actually different languages coexisting on the page. It looked so much more arcane and secret. And also, it helped that the older kids were reading it, that I think I just wanted to kind of jump beyond Torah as quickly as possible.
So there can be a feeling of wanting to get away from some central imposed book, and there can be a feeling of attachment to that central book, or to the commentaries on the book, or to the rituals surrounding the book. For the neuroscientist Lisa Feldman Barrett, religion in general could involve a kind of regulation of such feelings.
You know, most religions have some form of what's called secondary control, which means that by virtue of the rituals or traditions, you know, it's prescribed for you what you should feel at a given moment or how you should regulate what you feel. You can find this really in all traditions, all rituals, of whether or not they make mention of it. I mean, I grew up in a Jewish household, and many, many, many Jewish traditions and rituals are regulating what you should feel and how you should feel it and how you should express it. You can go all the way from a dyad interacting two adults or an adult and a child or two children to more informal social rules where, you know, if I make myself predictable to you, then you become predictable to me, and then we get along and everything goes smoothly. Like, you know, we all understand that when we see a red light, it means stop, and when we see a green light, it means go. Because we follow those rules, we all agree that these are rules we're going to follow. We don't kill each other by mistake, right? And there are rules for when you stand and when you sit and when you laugh and when you cry at movies, at funerals, and so on. And so these are all ways that we regulate each other's nervous systems, but in a more systematic way. And then you have something like religion, which is even a little more systematic because there are specific rituals that are performed and traditions and so on for the purposes of emotion, regulating each other's nervous systems. And then you have these really formal systems of law where the norms are entrenched and upheld by threats of punishment if you don't follow them.
For Peter Cole, the Bible does more than just constrain, although there is, as he describes it, a biblical burden.
You know, when you asked me to participate in this, I thought, you know, oi, I've already gone on pretty conspicuous record as saying that the Bible is a pain in the desk chair. I didn't think of myself as somebody who really should be talking about this. But then when I think back to my writing life, the Bible has been there at every step, in the foreground, the background, always nearby. I guess the reason I say that it's a pain in the desk chair is because poets who have dealt a lot with the Bible in any steady way, they've always run the risk of never having escaped the weight of it, the burden of it. Leonard Cohen's got that great song, "I Was Born in Chains," which is a take on the Exodus story. And I was born in chains, but I was taken out of Egypt. I was bound to a burden, but the burden, it was raised. And for a lot of poets who are working with the Bible, you can sort of feel they never had that burden raised. You can feel the chains clanging around and rattling around as they go from verse to verse. And you feel the weight of it and the heaviness of it. But poetry is all about independence, and all about independence that sometimes maps a kind of dependence and linkage, but it's all about words that wake us up, not drag us down. So the first burden is being drawn to the text and this kind of magnetic pull that it has on me, on everybody, or on a lot of people, has had historically, and sensing immediately the possible trap. It's not that different from the dynamic of traditional biblical commentary, where readers are continually pulled into the text. So there's this kind of centripetal attraction or force being exerted on you. But then I think when commentaries really are working to make the old text new, to revitalize it, and certainly in the Kabbalistic commentaries, they're also centrifugal. They just hurl you out through beyond the text into the world, and you sort of come through the text and enter the world and see the world in completely new ways, or in slightly new ways, which is really what vision is all about, and maybe what poetry is all about. There's that great Talmudic line in the Talmud, or in the Mishnah from Perkei Avot, the sayings of the fathers attributed to the oddly or aptly named Rabbi Ben Bagbag. Turn it and turn it, everything is in it. Look or see through it or into it, grow gray with it. Do not turn away from it. No measure is better. And it's really true. There's a way in which everything is somehow in it, but only if you use it as a tool for reflection or a prism, so that both you and the world end up in its pages somehow refracted by the texts. Beyond that, the agon, I guess, for me is most poets, most writers who deal with the Bible are really interested in character in the famous stories. And I started out that way, but I outgrew that pretty quickly. So there is that sense of, you know, whenever anybody says, there's a story to that. Most people say, can't live without stories. I can live without stories. Or, well, I haven't tried. But what I can't live with is without music and without a certain heightened attention to sound. That's what really floats my boat. It's having to deal in a certain sense with the weight of the story, the beginning, the middle, and end of all those stories, and kind of wringing them for morals. That's always put me off and kept me at a distance, even as I'm pulled back in all the time.
I'm imagining something like doors swinging open and shut that could close you in but also bounce you out. The more I talk to people about the Hebrew Bible, the more I hear about this kind of fluctuation between structure that closes you in and something that drives you beyond the structure, drives you beyond the gates, outside enclosure. Joshua Cohen described to me a routine habit that generates more than routine via commentary, via reading, via writing.
There was also the many repetitions or the times kind of we went through the Torah. I mean, Jews read the Torah kind of through every year. And in a way, a traditional education is like that as well. You constantly pass over through it looking for different meanings. And it's the establishment of these types of meanings that I think teach you how to think, teach you how to learn. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, there are the Bible stories that you would get as a kid. And then there's the ability to read the Bible consecutively, so you're not just kind of jumping from story to story. And then there is the way in which the exegetical comes into play. You know, specifically, Pardes is the acronym for this. And it was that, you know, every line, every word, depending on who you're talking to, every letter, has at least four levels of meaning. They're Peshat, Remez, Zerash, and Sod. They form an acronym that's called Pardes, which kind of also means essentially paradise, right? Eden. And what those four levels of interpretation are, you have a Peshat, which is the surface meaning, which is just the literal direct meaning of what the sentence says and it's most taken at face value. You have Remez, which is it means like a hint, and it's the sort of hidden meaning, maybe an allegorical meaning or an analogical meaning beyond the literalism. You have Darash then, which is somewhere between inquiring and to look within, to seek. And that's to find a meaning in comparison with other passages that use the same terminologies or use the same kind of formulations and also have the same, not just use the same words, but maybe involve the same gematric values of letters. It's essentially like comparing them with like passages throughout the literature. And then you have Sod, which is, you know, the oddest one, which it means secret. And it's the sort of esoteric or some would say Kabbalistic interpretation that really kind of comes to you through a mystical contemplation of the text, like a meditation on it. You know, these processes were slowly introduced to a student, right? Are slowly introduced to a student. And they're introduced through consecutive repetitions through the text. And these repetitions begin to structure your mind and begin to structure your life. Was that too long of an answer?
It wasn't, and it made me think about the central role of interpretation with a book full of so much complexity. It's probably not a coincidence that one of history's most famous interpreters, Sigmund Freud, that dream-interpreting founding psychoanalyst, had a formative literary experience with the Bible. Here's Tom DeRose of the Freud Museum in London.
It starts really with the Philipson Bible, the Bible that was produced by the Philipson brothers. And Freud was kind of reading and thinking quite early on, you know, and very much engaging with this particular text. And I don't know if you know the Philipson Bible, but it's a beautiful edition of the Bible, which has the Hebrew text on one side and the German text on the other. And there's also a kind of running commentary on the text, you know, regarding the kind of customs, the archaeology, the iconography, of kind of ancient Egypt, particularly, and things. So, and as well as that, there it has pages of these beautiful woodcuts. And it's quite a controversial text, of course. You know, having the images in the Hebrew Bible, you know, is not something that was particularly well received in all quarters. But at the very beginning of Freud's life, that remembrance, and he refers to this in his autobiographical study, that kind of gave him a kind of inspiration, actually.
I wanted to know if Joshua Cohen saw similar critical directions inspired by a biblical Talmudic education. Does this have more of a bearing on your thinking as a critic than as a novelist?
It was just from such a young age. Who knows, man? I mean, it was so fundamental. In a way, when someone says to me, we're going to do a podcast series or, you know, on the Bible, it's sort of like, let's do a podcast series on the alphabet.
Yeah.
That's how absolutely fundamental it is. It's like, or like, let's talk about carbon and its importance to life. It's very, very difficult to think about because I don't remember a life without it.
It seems like there are these two conflicting sides to this experience. One is that it is a book that imposes ritual, describes ritual, generates ritual, and also a book that is at the base of all this interpretive, investigative meaning-making or meaning exploration. Do they seem linked to you?
They're clear to me, or as clear as I need them to be from a historical point of view, certainly. I'm not going to, you know, get into the questions of biblical authorship. I think that's a crazy field for crazy people and they should all enjoy it. But in the most kind of zoomed out, you know, bird's eye view sense, you have this document that essentially tells a story of a people's formation and its formation into a nation, and then that nation finding a state, finding a kingdom, cohering a people from slavery. You have a family that, in order to deal with a famine, goes to Egypt. And from that initial seed is born a disparate nation of slaves who then find freedom and wander as a return back to the land that had been promised them. But when you ask about the distinction between, you know, its storytelling, let's say, and its interpretive tradition, you know, once that land is settled and there is political governance in the land and there is a, you know, even if it becomes a, you know, a client state or a partially, you know, a many times invaded and partially occupied state, you have a power structure that inheres in a king and in a priestly caste in a temple. And at that point, you know, you have this problem, which we've, you know, now returned to in the 20th century of, you know, Jewish autonomy. But after the destruction of the first temple in the Babylonian exile, you have people who no longer have a political center, and they begin feeling the need to codify the oral law to preserve the ways in which their people lived when they had their own land. Following the second temple's destruction under the Romans, you have a concerted effort to create a body of law and a body of standardized, you know, norms and principles that could be disseminated throughout the Jewish world for people who no longer lived within a state. Everything that you're calling sort of the Talmudic apparatus was really made for exile, to preserve the traditions of a homeland for a people who had lost one.
And so there's something preservative about the critical mechanism.
Absolutely. The entire hermeneutics is an attempt to preserve. Absolutely. And to communicate memory from, you know, I mean, you know, all of Talmud begins essentially with giving the generations of succession of who received the law from whom, you know, from Moses at Sinai down to, you know, the Sanhedrin. You know, when you ask about the distinction between the Bible and the Talmud in the most broad sense, to my mind, it's, you know, one is the story of a formation of the people, and the other is the story of how that people cohered without a land. Like, you know, one is the story of how a people coheres and finds its way to a land, and the other is a story of how a people maintains that coherence without the land.
That coherence flows beyond the Jewish tradition too, and through translations. I asked Peter Cole about the King James Version of the Christian Bible and about what that translation offers.
Generally speaking, a kind of majesty, a unified, elevated tone in the narrative sections, and certainly in the prophetic sections. In the book of Proverbs, there's texture. There's certainly a thickness that I like of texture. I mean, thickness in a good sense. You feel the materiality of the language. But what you get in the book of Proverbs is more the moral sense is brought out, which is not exactly what I'm seeing there in those Proverbs. What I'm seeing is a kind of situational dynamics, something more koan-like, where they're traps, they're verbal traps that are trying to enmesh your consciousness and take hold of you so that you'll remember them and put yourself in the situations and weigh out like two pans of a scale what's really going on or what the proverb is trying to get across. In Ecclesiastes, what you get is just majestic rhythms in the King James. The swells and tonal modulations of Ecclesiastes come through, I think, very, very powerfully in the King James.
The translations of the Bible themselves seem to promise ideas for continual renewal, renovation. I asked Peter Cole about characters in the Bible who represent that kind of renewal, that kind of change.
Some scholars just don't buy the whole idea that they're really characters in the Bible, that they're developed in the modern sense or in the way we look to in literary texts to have characters develop. But yes, I mean, Abraham from the beginning, this central change is he leaves his homeland. He's in pursuit of some new idea. His name changes. That really sets the pattern for almost everything that happens. And all the different characters are crossing in some way. Abraham crosses in one direction. Joseph and his brothers go cross in another direction. They go down, and then they cross back in. And that seems to be the paradigm of movement, development in some kind of inner way, and then a crossing over, right? That's even etymologically the Hebrews, the Ivrim, are those who cross over. At least that's one possible etymology. So that's also built into the entire system.
Those are all Torah characters. What about the figures in the later books, in Nevi'im, the book with the prophets like Isaiah and Jeremiah foreseeing destruction?
Well, I mean, the prophets are pre-teachers because you don't have rabbis really until the destruction of the temples. And what the prophets are doing is warning that the kingdom will be overrun, the kingdom will be destroyed. You know, you have the prophetic writings, which are essentially the, you know, monitory alarm that the days of the temple and God's authority are over, that the time in which the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, goes into the Holy of Holies and stands within the presence of God, that this is about to be destroyed. And so the prophetic writings are very much, or the prophetic mode in the Jewish tradition, is very much of the eve of destruction. And the age of prophecy wanes and becomes an age of scholarship.
So prophecy is pre-destruction.
What are these guys talking about? What is Jeremiah talking about? He's saying it's all over. What is Yeshayahu? What is that, you know, Isaiah talking about? It's all over.
Yeah. They don't deliver good news. Exactly.
No, but the bad news is specifically about the destruction of the kingdom.
Can we extend that point you made to say that a novel written in 2022 in some way registers something that was destroyed before it? Like, is the entire tradition of the novel an extension of something like this, an extension of individual writers reacting to something lost, some connection to something preceding their solitary literary career that is lost?
I think this is what we're talking about is so fundamental, not just to our culture, but to the idea of culture, that, you know, to say that there's some sort of novelistic corollary would be insane. I mean, in my mind. But I mean, this is about letters, man. This is about letters. This is about words. This is about why letters form words. This is about why alphabets exist and what role letters play in the defining of words or in imbuing words with meaning that are not just their literary meanings, their literal meanings, sorry.
So it's, I mean, and that's the way that the Bible was studied in the tradition I grew up. It was not, you know, it was, what does the story tell? Sure. Or what does this mean in terms of the mitzvot, the laws we have to follow? But primarily it was, what mystical weight do these letters have? Why is God plural, right? Why is Elohim plural? You know, why is God's other name, one of God's other names, you know, four letters, Yud, He, Vav, He? And what do those letters mean? And the Tetragrammaton. Beyond that, why doesn't Hebrew have a word to be, or in, a word for is, you know, in the present tense, a word for to be in the present tense? What is the relationship between God's name and the idea of the present tense? The present tense in Hebrew is called hoveh, right? You know, avar is the past, hoveh is the present, atid is the future. This is just grammatical tenses. Hoveh is the present. It is essentially a combination, a recombination of the name of God. You know, does this teach us that God is within the present tense? That God is in fact the present tense, which is why we have no word for it, no word for is or to be in the present tense? That's how fundamental the materials of the Bible are.
Thank you for listening to Mosaic Mosaic, the third season of the Cosmic Library. Our guests this season include Peter Cole, the poet whose new book, Draw Me After, will be out this fall. Elisa Gabbert, poet and poetry columnist with the New York Times. Her latest book is Normal Distance. Lisa Feldman Barrett, psychologist, neuroscientist, and author of books including How Emotions Are Made. Tom DeRose, curator at the Freud Museum in London. And Joshua Cohen, the novelist whose books include Book of Numbers. This has been our introductory episode. Next up, we're talking about the emotions of law.